You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm John Rubino, sitting in for Jay Taylor, who's on vacation this week with his lovely wife, Teresa. He'll be back next week. With me is Doug Nolan, who's been a money manager, mostly on the short side of the market, for going on 3 decades, most recently with McIlvaney Wealth Management's Tactical Short Strategy Service. I've been following Doug's published work for going on 20 years now, and consider him to be the sharpest observer of our ongoing financial madness. So welcome, Doug. Good to talk to you.
Hi, John. It's great to be on, and it's a treat for me to be on with you because I've admired your work for a long time, your writing, your website, and also this gives me an opportunity to thank you for highlighting my work over the years. Greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Fantastic. Yeah. One of the things that that occurred to me as I was writing up the intro here, Doug, is that we've been doing this for a really long time. I've been following your work for decades, and you've been analyzing what is basically a completely unsustainable, unprecedented credit bubble that has been going on for a really, really long time. So the question that arises from that is, how the heck did they keep this thing going for as long as they have? It doesn't seem possible just based on the numbers, and yet here we are.
Yeah, it's been incredible. I really dove into the macro analysis going all the way back to, the Japanese bubble experience in the late 80s. By the late 90s, I was convinced that we had completely fundamentally changed finance, right? It was out with the old banking system, in with securitizations, Wall Street finance, hedge funds, repos, asset-backed securities, mortgage backs, the GSEs, right? We had fundamentally changed finance. And I was convinced once the Fed figured this out and they saw how unstable this unfettered finance was, that they would kind of rein it in. And, we saw various bubbles blow up. We saw the bond market blow up in 1994. We saw the Mexican collapse, Southeast Asia in 96, 97. And then the wheels almost came off in 1998 with, the collapse of Russia and long-term capital management. But each time, instead of the Fed recognizing how unstable this was, it was like they created these bailouts and flooded the system with liquidity and backstopped the markets, and the bubble just got bigger and bigger. And, I started my blog, and before they were called blogs, in 1999, thinking the bubble would burst imminently, and it did burst in 2000. But then in 2002, I had to change my tune, and I started warning about the mortgage finance bubble because the Fed was specifically targeting mortgage finance to reflate the system after the bursting of the tech bubble. So then I chronicled that the whole time, and the excesses were unbelievable to me. They kept rates so low as long as they did and didn't try to rein in the mortgage excesses at all. And then when that bubble burst in 2008, again, I thought, that's it, the bubble burst. Well, again, in 2009, I think it was April of 2009, I had to change my tune again, and I started warning about the unfolding global government finance bubble because it was clear the central banks were going to use central bank credit, sovereign debt. They were going to throw the kitchen sink at this thing, do things that we never even imagined possible to reflate the system again. But I had no idea back in 2008, 2009 that we would literally have, we're up to $15, $16 trillion of money created out of nothing by the central banks, and interest rates are still near zero in most of the places, most of the countries around the world. And now markets everywhere just believe that we don't have to worry about bear markets. We don't have to worry about recession because central banks are right there to make sure they don't happen. So from my analytical framework, this has gotten so beyond what anyone thought was possible. And not to ramble on this, but I know when Governor Bernanke came on to the Fed back in 2002, I'm thinking, this guy's crazy. The government printing press and helicopter money, this guy's crazy. And who knew that he would end up being the Fed chairman and the whole world would adopt such radical monetary policy? But that's kind of what's got us to where we are today.
Well, you know, one of the questions I get from people who are justifiably tired of hearing all these gloom and doom predictions that just don't seem to pan out is maybe the world is so different that they have figured out how to just keep this going forever. In other words, does it have to end? If it hasn't ended yet, what is it that will eventually end this thing?
Sure. And, you know, bubbles do win. They're, you know, in my definition, they're a self-reinforcing but inevitably unsustainable inflation. We've seen this massive inflation going on for 30 years. What makes this bubble period that's going on a decade now so dangerous is because not only has it gone global and it's gone across asset classes, right? Security markets, real estate, private business, you can go right down the list. It's everywhere. It's gotten to the very heart, the very foundation of global finance. It's gotten to central bank credit and sovereign debt. So that is money, and the danger of money is it's special and it has insatiable demand, so governments can print as much as they want. We have, you know, centuries of history of this kind of thing, of inflationism. The problem is, at the end of the day, these are just electronic journal entries. There's no real wealth behind trillions and trillions of perceived wealth. One of these days, there's going to be a crisis of confidence in central bank credit, in debt. So I don't think you can continue to inflate all of this phony money forever until someone will say, well, wait a minute, I think I've got enough of this. Maybe I'll sell this and buy something that I think will sustain value over time. So this can't go on forever. This is, you know, we've never had anything like this in history, but it's a similar dynamic in that it's credit growth and manipulation of credit, manipulation of values, and at the end of the day, that's not going to work.
Okay, so are you saying that currency valuations are the thing that eventually brings the system down? In other words, people lose faith in the dollar and the euro and the yen. And when that happens, central banks no longer have the tools that they need to keep this thing going. Am I paraphrasing correctly?
Yeah. Okay. That's true. And John, what I would add is, let's get this real time. I think the market is starting to question, do I want to be exposed to central bank credit in Turkey? Do I want to be exposed to central bank credit sovereign debt in Brazil? Argentina, we've already seen the mess in Venezuela. So we're already seeing the market decide, I think I'm okay without playing that credit inflation. I don't want to do that. In the short term, when you have these beginning of lack of confidence at the periphery, and we saw this back with subprime in 2007, a lot of times that can lead to a flow of finance to the core, which we're seeing in U.S. financial assets. And basically what that does is it just exacerbates the bubble at the core, the excesses at the core, and only makes the whole system more vulnerable to a collapse. But I don't think it's a stretch at all to think people would question the sustainability of wealth and credit in the emerging markets today. We're seeing it.
Yeah, the emerging markets were the darlings of Wall Street for a couple of years there, right? That's where everybody was putting their money, including retirees, on the advice of their financial planners. And now you're seeing these things blow up one after another. Is there an end to the process in, for instance, Latin America? Can anything on that continent survive if Brazil blows up, for instance, and Argentina and Venezuela all at the same time?
Yeah, and I think I've been doing this too long because, I remember, the devastating emerging market collapses even, during the 80s, and then the Mexican collapse in 95 in Southeast Asia, which was devastating. The emerging markets function very well as long as credit is loose and international funds are flowing readily into the markets, into their economy. They become a disaster if the hot money seeks an exit and a quick exit. Again, we've seen this repeatedly over the years. We've never seen the amount of finance go into these economies as we've seen the past decade. We've never experienced this with an ETF complex where a lot of, you know, savers have put money into emerging markets. As you say, they've been recommended by many folks, and everyone thinks that they have a liquid vehicle that if they want to get out, they just get out. Well, I'm sorry, the emerging markets can turn very illiquid when the hot money tries to get out. So I just can't believe we don't learn from previous experiences, and I'm very concerned by what has started to unfold. You mentioned Latin America. Yeah, but it's also, you know, it's Asia, it's Eastern Europe. It's very concerning, very concerning.
Okay. Now, one of the reasons that we've had the recovery that we've had from a crisis that we probably shouldn't have been able to recover from is that all the world's central banks have been coordinated. Everybody's been easing at the same time until this year. And now they're starting to diverge, right? The Fed is starting to tighten a bit. The ECB is talking about tightening. And the Bank of Japan is still really easy. So is that divergence a big deal from your point of view?
Yes, I think it is. And we've seen these, you know, this extraordinary concerted reflation effort by the world central banks, you know, for a decade. And so long as they were all inflating together, and that's inflating security markets, inflating asset markets, credit was inflating, the economies were all inflating, there was this appearance of stability. But history, you know, it teaches us repeatedly that inflationism, it's always such a slippery slope. And once you go down that path, it's extremely difficult to get off of it. Inflationary consequences over time evolve, and they always become increasingly problematic. They catch up to you. So now we see these divergences, and this illusion of stability is beginning to fade. The Fed's they've had loose policy on now for a decade now. It's been far too long, and major imbalances have developed. You've had here in the U.S. bubbles in the stock market and corporate credit, these massive unending fiscal deficits that now only get worse, the reemergence of real estate bubbles, an economic maladjustment that people won't appreciate until the bubble bursts. But the Fed fell behind the curve, and now they're hoping to normalize policy without sparking a crisis. But, the prospect for higher U.S. rates is hitting the emerging markets hard. And again, it's been a historic bubble in the emerging markets. It's beginning to falter. And this collapsing EM bubble, it dims global growth prospects, right? The emerging markets have been key to growth for a decade now. And it also puts downward pressure on U.S. yields, which is essentially overriding the Fed's efforts to tighten financial conditions. So what I see in my parlance, you know, the Fed rate hikes are causing acute stress at the periphery, and this strain works to exacerbate speculative flows and lower yields here at the core in the U.S., stimulating what I refer to as the terminal phase of excess that we see at the end part of the cycle. So the whole global system has become conspicuously dysfunctional. And I think this divergence ensures, extreme global financial economic instability for years to come. I hope I'm wrong on this, but that's the way I see it.
Well, for people who are trying to time this, is there an indicator that we can use to give us a sense of, you know, where we are in this process of years of financial instability? For instance, you mentioned interest rates, where at the long end, rates are kind of coming down lately in the U.S. and they're going up in the short, and which means that we're seeing the yield curve collapse and possibly invert in the not too distant future. So is that something that is a short term signal when it happens that we've got immediate trouble in front of us?
Right. And I'm reminded of a saying I've said over the years that, you know, bubbles go to unimaginable extremes and then double. So I don't recommend anyone try to, you know, I'm doing the best I can here, but these things tend to go on a lot longer, the greater excess than we would expect. But I'll also say when they start to unravel, they can catch everybody flat-footed because they can unravel quickly. I personally believe the global bubble has been pierced. We're seeing it in emerging markets. I actually think what we saw in February also with the unwind of these short vol, all these derivative products, which were, you know, essentially variations of writing flood insurance during a drought. I think that was the initial signal, similar to subprime in June of 2007 with the collapse of a couple of Bear Stearns structured credit funds. But I also warned, you know, back in 2007, it took 15 months from the initial subprime eruption to the crisis. So this could drag on for a bit, but I think what is unfolding in emerging markets has attained momentum that will be difficult to reverse. And so I think it's time to pay close attention to what's unfolding in markets, and don't be complacent just because U.S. markets are, you know, have traded close to record highs. You know, we saw similar market dynamics in late 2007.
Okay, which was in retrospect a pretty good time to start shorting, right? And you just got back into short selling with your relationship with McIlvany Financial. So good timing. I think you're going to have fun for the next few years.
Well, you know, we'll work hard and do our best. It's always a challenge. And yeah. You had mentioned the yield curve. So I also want to mention that was a very important signal in 2007, right? Even though mm-hmm. stocks went to all-time highs, oil, you know, crude went to what was $140, $145 a barrel. That yield curve was telling you trouble was coming. And I always pay more attention to the fixed income market for market indicators than I do equities. And certainly, you know, the yield curve is indicating trouble ahead, I think.
Okay. So at what point does the yield curve become an imminent signal? In other words, does it have to invert? Short rates have to go above long rates? Or can we just get towards zero and then start? Because, you know, I'm trying to figure out what to short, Doug. I know it's dangerous. I want to replicate The Big Short. I watched that movie and decided that this time around I want to be one of those guys. So the timing is very important. And a good signal that tells us when in the next 6 months we should be shorting stuff would be really nice. So can you say anything about that with regard to the yield curve?
Sure. And you're a sophisticated investor, John, but for the average guy out there, and again, I'll show my age here, when it comes to shorting stocks, I just thought back to, you know, Nancy Reagan saying, just say no. But anyways, it's tough to short. The analysis right now is extremely challenging. Back in, you know, in the mortgage finance bubble period, it was a, you know, U.S.-centric bubble. It was mortgage finance. So my indicators are pretty clear. You know, subprime was the periphery. Once subprime, cracked and you had a lack of liquidity at the fringe of mortgage finance, I was convinced that was the beginning of the end. This is a global bubble. I can't look to U.S. credit spreads as good indicators like I could back in 07. So okay. I look more to global indicators, which are flashing, you know, time to pay attention, but also how this navigates from the periphery of EM to the core of U.S. credit. That's something we're just going to have to follow daily, weekly, monthly. And again, it can take a while, and then all of a sudden it can speed up. But I'm not seeing, you know, I don't see the stress. We've seen some widening of credit spreads, especially in investment grade credit. The junk's holding together pretty well, and there's no indications of liquidity shortfall in U.S. credit at this point.
Okay. All right, Doug. Well, that's a perfect place to end it. We've got about 30 seconds left, so I'll say goodbye and do the last little bit, and that'll be it. So thanks. It was great talking to you.
Hey, great talking with you, John. Thanks so much for having me on today. Real treat for me to talk with you. Take care.
Great. Okay, so that's it for today. Next week, Jay's scheduled guests are Jeff Deist, former chief of staff to Congressman Ron Paul, and newsletter writer Louis James, who will talk about some of the same companies that Jay follows. Michael Oliver will not be available next week, but Jay's hopeful that he'll be available the following week. Thanks for listening. It's been a fun hour hosting the show, and good luck out there.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Bonterra Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Auren Resources is a technically driven, capital-efficient exploration company focused on delivering shareholder value through accretive project acquisition and discovery. The company's management team has a record of success in the discovery, advancement, and monetization of exploration assets. Auren's focus is on advancing its seven premier gold exploration projects located in Canada and Peru. Auren's shares trade on the TSX in Canada and the NYSE American in the U.S. under the stock symbol AUG. For more information, please visit AurenResources.com.